Hi, I'm Ruthie, and I have a recorder.
Stick them up.
Listen to Out There on Wednesdays, 4 to 5 p.m. here on Valley Free Radio for interviews and snippets of life from the paths and streets of Northampton. You can hear past editions of Out There archived at weatherbeard.com/out there.
And it is Wednesday, January, I think it's the 16th. Oh, yeah, look, there's a calendar. Wednesday, January 16th, the calendar had moved. Thanks for tuning in to Out There Today. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Got a bunch of riffraff on the agenda for this show today. I'm not sure exactly what all I got or I'm going to get to. But first, I'll tell you about what I have in my hands, which is, so from today's trash and recycling route, I noticed a butter container, a butter box from, you know, one of the 1 pound butter box from Lando Lakes. And the picture on it is a woman with long, dark, braided or twisted hair wearing a leather frilled jacket. The background is lakes, a lake with mountains. And she's got a headband with blue and red diamonds on it and a blue feather and a red feather sticking out of her headband. And I wondered what she had to do with the butter. For contrast, I got a Cabot Creamery butter box here. It's got a picture of a cow on it. And I thought, that makes sense. Butter comes from cows. And I have one more funny thing about the Lando Lakes brand dairy. So if you go to Pure Foods in East Hampton and you buy the White American, Lando Lakes White American cheese on the receipt, all it says is White American, LOL. All right, so thanks for tuning in to Out There. I'm going to start with a story. Story from my week. It's kind of a long story. But it all started this on Sunday in Eric and Laura's living room at a ceremony for Eric's dad's passing. The poster on the table was a poem by Hafiz called I'm So Glad. Start seeing everything as God, but keep it a secret. Become like a man who is awestruck and nourished, listening to a golden nightingale sing in a beautiful foreign language while God nests invisibly upon its tongue. Hafiz, who can you tell in this world that when a dog runs up to you, wagging its ecstatic tail, you bend down and whisper in its ear, Beloved, I am so glad that you are happy to see me. Beloved, I am so glad, so very glad that you have come. Reading this poem, I started to cry, not about Eric or his dad, but for my own memories of how every time I go home to my parents still alive, my mom, when I walk into her bedroom, she pops up from her bed with her arms wide open and in her unencumbered dementia shrieks, You're here! I didn't know you were coming. I'm so glad you're here. Thank you for coming, as she wraps her arms around me. My dad tells me, too, in a quieter way, but just as heartfelt, as we hug, and I notice how he feels bonier than last time I came. Gathered in the circle to remember Eric and his dad, I read the Hafiz poem and think of my friend David. He is relatively young and healthy and lives here in the valley, but I haven't seen him since August, and I miss him. I'm so glad for times in the past that we have connected. I want to send him the poem. When I get home from Eric's dad's ceremony, I find the poem online and write it on a piece of yellow construction paper with a little note to mail to David. I'm not sure how to spell David's last name, so I do an online web search. What I find is an obituary for his dad, who died this fall, a few days after he and I had our last communication. I had no idea. I'm definitely sending him this poem now, the poem of love and connection and appreciation. All this Sunday evening is as my housemate Ben and I are listening to the conference call about Eduardo Samaniego, a Western Mass activist acquaintance who's still locked up in ICE detention in Georgia, still in solitary confinement. He was denied bond at his last hearing and he has another hearing tomorrow, January 17th. The Pioneer Valley Workers Center suggests six actions you can take, or five or six, listed on their Facebook page, or if you go to hashtag Free Eduardo, you can find a list of things to do as well. And this includes making phone calls and writing letters to ICE officials. Here, get ready, because I'm going to give you two phone numbers you can call to ask for Eduardo's release. So if he's released, at least he can fight his case from the outside. You can call anytime, day or night, and leave a message. I've never gotten a live person when I've called, no matter the time. I just leave a message. So here are the numbers. The ICE Atlanta field director, Sean Gallagher, the number is 404-893-1206. And the assistant director, Kristen Sullivan, 404-893-1203. Again, that's the ICE Atlanta field director, Sean Gallagher, 404-893-1206. Or the assistant director, Kristen Sullivan, 404-893-1203. You can also write letters to Kirsten Nielsen, who's the Secretary of Homeland Security, 800 K Street Northwest, number 1000, Washington, D.C., 20528. And a sample letter might say something like, or a sample phone message might say something like, I'm writing or calling in support of Eduardo Samaniego, whose alien number is 206-862-839. My name is Ruthie. Eduardo is a well-known and much-loved leader with deep ties to his community in Georgia and Massachusetts. Eduardo studied at Hampshire College, where he served on the College Board of Trustees. While working for immigration justice in partnership with Pioneer Valley Workers Center, Eduardo regularly collaborated with Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern and Senators Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey. A person of faith, Eduardo also organized among diverse religious communities. We who are part of that broader community commit to supporting Eduardo throughout his immigration proceedings. Eduardo is not a flight risk, and we demand his immediate release on bond so that he can pursue medical treatment and legal remedies. Sincerely, Ruthie Woodring, or whoever. Anyway, so like I said, all this information can be found online. Just search for hashtag Free Eduardo. So today, Wednesday, January 16th, is a national day of action for Eduardo, with people all over the country delivering petitions to their local ICE office. There was a gathering in Springfield, Massachusetts, earlier this afternoon. All right, so anyway, so back to my personal story. So I don't know that it's really a story, but sequence of events and train of thought. So this conference call about Eduardo, that was Sunday evening. And then Monday morning, I woke up early and I was like, okay, I'm going to write a letter to ICE. So I woke up early and I wrote a draft letter, but I had to leave for work before I could finish it. And I hoped to return to it Monday evening, but I didn't. And then yesterday morning, I also hoped to work on it, but I had to leave for work without getting around to it. But as I left for work, leaving for work means hitching up the trailer to my bicycle and heading down the bike path. The thermometer said 12 degrees, which I was dressed for, but my bike was unhappy. When I got on it to ride it out of the yard, I nearly fell over because the pedals and the chain just spun around freely, both forward and backward. Now, if you're an all-season biker who doesn't have indoor bike parking, you may have experienced this phenomenon. You ride in cold, rainy weather one day, and then the temperature drops to single digits or low teens. And the next day, you try to ride your bike, and you can't go. The pedals and chain and gears spin, but there's no forward propulsion. Well, the problem is you've got water in your free hub, and the ratcheting mechanism that allows you to coast, it's what allows your wheel to turn while your feet, pedals, chain, and gears stay still. Like that inside the free hub, there's a little pawl. It's a little wedge of steel on a spring wire that engages with the internal teeth. The tiniest little wire, it makes everything engage. So your power means something. Well, when water gets in there and freezes it, the spring can't move the pawl, so it doesn't engage. The solution is melt or dry the ice. Put your rear wheel somewhere warm. In my situation, this Tuesday morning, I thought, oh, if I just head down the bike path with the trailer, I'll just sort of scooter along and, you know, I'll move I'll move my legs and the chain and the cassette around, and it'll come back to life, right? So that was my hope, that the free hub would just start to engage on its own. Because I was late to work already, and I didn't want to go back home, take off my pannier, empty my basket, release my brakes, take off my rear wheel with my mittens, and turn it all upside down, take my rear wheel inside and wait who knows how long. So I scootered my bike and trailer optimistically down the bike path, hoping something would magically change. It was pretty awkward scootering a bike with a 6-foot trailer behind. I scootered past Meadowbrook through the woods by the DPW and realized, no, I know I'm late already, but I need to go home and fix this problem. Or who knows how long it's going to last. I can't haul trash like this. So I unhitched the trailer and I left it along the bike path, and I scooted my bike back to my house. I was feeling stressed about time, but really, trash can wait. I took my rear wheel inside by the wood stove, wondering how long this would take. 3 minutes? 10 minutes? Half an hour? However long it was going to take, I knew I didn't have time for it. I squatted next to the wood stove, spinning the cassette back and forth, hoping to feel it catch. I thought of an email I had received the night before from someone in Kentucky near my parents' place, who I had met when I was there in September and had exchanged contact information with, who had then, on New Year's Eve, sent me a calendar. Being in touch with her, with someone, a new friend, from a place where I have roots but few friends, made me feel hopeful about connection. The whole reason I met her, Timmy, was because I was on the tandem bike with Shira, a Western Mass friend who had accompanied me to Kentucky for 2 weeks. That had meant so much to me, to have a friend from this life come with me to my past and future life. How can I explain the South, Appalachia, the homeland, to people from Northampton? It's not something that can be explained with words, but has to be lived. It's like the beauty of the mountains, the destruction of strip mining, and the complicity of people all over the country in this exploitation. That's the general theme of any people or place, the good, the bad, the interconnectedness. I thought of the Hafiz poem again, "I am so glad." Shira, do you know how glad, how very glad I am that you came to Kentucky with me? Timmy, do you know how glad I am, how very glad that you reached out to me? Please be with me. I was still squatted there next to the wood stove, spinning the cassette on my bike wheel. Tears of gratitude dripped onto my boots. And who do I reach out to? Eduardo! We need each other. We need to be there for each other. Eduardo, I remember you. I want to be there for you. I jumped up and grabbed the phone off the receiver and dialed 404-893-1206. That's the ICE office in Georgia. Or you can dial 404-893-1203. I said something like, well, kind of what I read before in the other letter. I can't remember exactly what I said, but I referenced the movie Selma that I started watching over the weekend. And, you know, like, we look back in history and things right and wrong sometimes seem so obvious, but in this moment, we get lost in the justifications or rationalizations, it feels like. Anyway, when I hung up the phone and went back to my bike wheel, it had begun to work. I had to laugh. I didn't have time to make the calls because I was late for work. But when I had bike malfunction, of course I had time to fix it. There was no choice, which in turn gave me time to make the calls. Such a blessing in disguise. One more thing about this, the poem by Hafiz. Well, not really about the poem, but you know who Hafiz reminds me of? Jeff Tobin. Jeff is a Hilltown artist, lover of life, poet, presence. I have a story about running into him accidentally one day. That day, I was doing diaper deliveries for a cloth diaper washing service. That was when Simple Diaper and Linen was still in existence. Well, I didn't have a trailer because I just had one large bag of diapers to pick up, and I figured I could just strap it to my rack. Okay, so it wasn't the most stable, but it was upright. As I was biking through downtown Florence, coming up to a red light at Maple Street, I needed to get in the left turn lane, slipping through traffic already stopped at the light and traffic slowing from behind. I cut in behind a gray sedan with colorful paint streaks on it, but because of the high center of gravity of the heavy diapers attached to my rear rack, my bike didn't go exactly where I wanted it to, and I ended up bumping the back of the stopped gray car. I walked, or waddled, straddling my bike alongside the driver's window to apologize. And the man inside, who was Jeff, said with his glowing smile, "Oh, that's okay, Ruthie. It's an honor to be bumped by your bike. It's like I've been blessed by it." I nominate this guy for the Hafiz Award. And you are listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. And here's some Eddie Grant.
You got me.
All right, you're tuned in to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP in Northampton, Massachusetts. A couple of announcements. This Saturday, January 19th, the Pioneer Valley Women's March will hold the third annual Women's March in Northampton. The march officially called the Women's Wave to reflect the success of women in the midterms. We'll start at Sheldon Field at noon and go down Route 9 to City Hall for a rally. The rally will feature local community speakers and music and will be followed by a community activists fair at First Churches on Main Street, where area organizations will table and offer marchers practical ways to plug into our larger community. The Pioneer Valley Women's March is one of hundreds of sister marches planned nationally and worldwide on January 19th. To mark the anniversary of the 2017 International Women's March mobilization. Speakers include Tanisha Arena, Executive Director of Arise for Social Justice, State Senator Joe Comerford, State Rep Lindsay Sabadosa, Malaka Samdani, Executive Director of Critical Connections, Kamini Waldman, Vice President of the Northampton High Democrats. Also performers including The Hoping Machine, Prone to Mischief, and Zoki. We celebrate not only the women who were elected, but the thousands of women who helped get them elected or worked in other ways to promote equality and justice. And also coming up Wednesday, January 23rd. Hang on, I gotta go down to the floor and pick up the mouse. I just dropped the mouse. That electronic device mouse. Okay, Wednesday, January 23rd, that's next Wednesday. Today is the 16th. That's how good I am with numbers. Join my, what do you call it? My flexibility with numbers. Can't even think of the word, whatever it is. Anyway, okay. Heart Conscious Communication Workshop. What to say when you don't agree. Are you tired of arguing? Learn to communicate with authenticity and open-heartedness. There's a free intro class facilitated by Karen Fogliati. It's based on NVC, Nonviolent Communication, the Nonviolent Communication Work of Marshall Rosenberg. This is Wednesday, January 23rd, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Friends Meeting House. This is a follow-up workshop after that. It costs a bunch of money. You can go online, heartconsciouscommunication.com. Now, I'm going to play my next personal spiel. This one's only about 3 minutes long. Where are we? All right, this is from this morning when I was doing downtown trash.
I recently watched the documentary Whose Streets about the movement that erupted in Ferguson, Missouri after the police killing of unarmed teenager Michael Brown in 2014. What a lot of white America saw was riots. A riot is the language of the unheard. That's what was broadcast on major media. People who were in the streets, the footage of the people who were there, shows a different story. People trying to express their frustrations, almost exclusively nonviolently, met with tanks, machine guns, automatic weapons whose laser eyes were trained on protesters. The courage of people in Ferguson to stand up and be in the streets, demanding to be heard in the face of such oppression, is breathtaking. It's something we should all aspire to. To see the level of disrespect and cruelty that Black Americans have faced and continue to face in many situations in this country, I feel deeply indebted to people who risk their lives to make this country a more just place. Black Americans whose ancestors have been here for hundreds of years longer than mine, who should be owning this place for all the labor that they and their ancestors have put into it, if anyone can own a place. Recently, a pretty well-educated, white, Connecticut resident, city administrator type said to me, "I don't understand why Black people didn't make more progress when Barack Obama was president. We didn't have time to get into it in that moment. But when I consider the Black Americans from Ferguson who have spoken out and then have gotten murdered and have lost their lives in the 4 years since then. And on October 17th of 2018, Donye Jones was found hung in his mother's backyard. His mother, Melissa McKinney's, was a prominent Ferguson activist. When I saw this film about events in Ferguson the year after Michael Brown was shot, I wondered, where was I? Where was I when a white police officer who shot an unarmed black man 10 times and then claimed that he looked like he had a demon in his eyes and then claimed that he had no racism in him and you can't be racist and be in the police force. Thanks to all the black freedom fighters, our liberation is tied up together. May white people be willing to take more risks. Also, thanks to coming together for putting on this film and their series of educational events to make us all more aware.
A couple of points of clarification on that thing. The name of the film was Whose Streets? I saw it last night at the Jones Library in Amherst, and it was put on by Coming Together. And the quote, "A riot is the language of the unheard," that's by Martin Luther King Jr. Speaking of Martin Luther King Jr., this Monday is Martin Luther King Day, and the annual 35th annual Martin Luther King Day celebration put on by the Resistance Center in Northampton will include a 10 a.m. Afro-American Heritage Trail Walk starting at the Sojourner Truth statue in Florence. At 1 p.m., convocation and children's celebration at Edwards Church in downtown Northampton. And at 2:30, there'll be workshops by community organizations. There'll be a panel discussion with Dr. Usman Power Green, Jacqueline Velez of Dr. Usman Power Green is from Clark University. Jacqueline Velez is from Neighbor to Neighbor Holyoke, and Tanisha Arena from Arise for Social Justice, moderated by Justine Diamond of Belchertown Voices for Justice and Springfield College. And there will be music by Bomba De Aquí. That's Monday, the 21st, Martin Luther King Day. And
this is Ruthie from Pedal People here at this recycling bin to remind you that cups are not recyclable. I know you want to, but don't do it because it just means that your local trash hauler has to pick them out, or the worker on the line at the MRF in Springfield has to pick them out, or potentially it could contaminate the entire load of recycling, meaning the entire load is now trash. So no cups in the recycling, and ideally no plastic cups anywhere. Thank you.
All right, that's enough talking by me on this show. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring, and here's some Buffy St. Marie.
Straight, stand.
All right, next I'm going to play something, a little mini podcast by David Rovix. David Rovix is a singer, songwriter, commentator, activist, someone that I knew from my Chicago Catholic Worker rabble-rousing days that I've been recently in touch with, and he let me know about this podcast he's doing. This one is called Living Room Elephant.
Hello. This is David Rovix with episode 23 of This Week with David Rovix, which is available via the David Rovix mobile app at davidrovix.com/thisweek or on any of the usual podcasting platforms if you search for This Week with David Rovix. Every episode is also posted on SoundCloud and the Pacifica Radio Audio Port for free download. It's a new year, and I, for one, am going to start it out by talking about the elephant in the living room. What's that, you wonder? Well, let's see. If we turn on the news, we'll hear a lot about the government shutdown, the tear gassing of refugees on the border, Trump's demand for a wall, partisan conflict, Trump's racism and xenophobia, the volatility of the stock market, the possible candidacy of Senator Elizabeth Warren in the 2020 presidential race, the trade war with China, and the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria. What you'll hear so little about are the things that affect most of us here the most, which have almost complete bipartisan support among our political elite, such as our military budget, which is just about as big as the rest of the world's combined, and such as the cost of housing, which has been steadily rising throughout the country under both Republican and Democratic rule for decades, more so in Senator Warren's Massachusetts than almost anywhere. Where I live, in the biggest city in the formerly official white homeland state of Oregon, the exclusion laws successfully kept the state very white for a very long time. But starting in the 1940s, Oregon developed a small but growing African-American community centered around the northern and northeastern parts of the state's only major city, Portland. In between the last two censuses, between 2000 and 2010, Portland lost half of its black population. Did Trump's racism do that? Did xenophobia do that? How about sexism or transphobia? Maybe the proliferation of guns, police brutality, perhaps. The Tea Party, the Republicans. Not to belittle any other important social issues, but no, none of these things. What is ethnically cleansing Portland, and cleansing it of its working class and artist population generally, is the uncontrolled rise in the cost of housing. And only regulation of the market in the form of strict rent control and other legal measures can begin to stop this trend, let alone reverse it. But such policies have been opposed by the leadership of both parties. We're told rent control doesn't work, though they never explain why, and they disregard all the countries in Europe where it works great. This isn't Europe, I'm told, when I bring up Europe. I don't know what they mean by that, other than the obvious question of geography, and neither do they. Beginning in January of 2019, the state of Oregon has a Democratic supermajority. For all you foreigners listening, that means the Democratic Party politicians in the legislature have total control over the legislature. Their party's politics are all that matters. There is no meaningful opposition. If the Democratic Party represents the interests of the working class, then the new Democratic legislature will immediately pass the nation's strictest rent control laws to deal with what they themselves have declared is a housing emergency. Though so far, their only suggestions for dealing with it have been the social equivalent of a new paint job on a rotting structure. Gentrification is genocide, is what it used to say all over New York City in the 80s. It was a mantra of the squatters movement. It was a familiar concept for lots of the locals who weren't squatters too, many of whom at that time in the Lower East Side were from the Dominican Republic. I remember a squatter explaining it to me. Our strategy, he said, is to make sure we have strong enough defenses to keep the cops out for an hour. That's how long it takes for folks in the neighborhood to hear about what's going on. Then the cops worry there'll be a real riot, and they retreat. The concept of cops retreating was such a heady idea, I could barely believe it at the time. Then the police department got a sort of tank with a battering ram attached to it, and this was a problem. As these battles were taking place in New York City, most of the rest of the country, one state at a time, was abolishing the practice of rent control. That is, state after state was taking the right away from city governments to have any control over what landlords charged their tenants. 48 out of 50 state legislatures were all saying to their elected municipal and county leaders, "You may not have any democratic control over the most basic economic relationship in our society, that between landlord and tenant." By the time the urban cores of so many once abandoned cities became popular to live in again, it was too late. Rent control was not an obstacle, and landlords made trillions just from raising the rent. "Whatever the market will bear" is their motto. In the two-bedroom apartment where I am now raising three children, the rent has more than doubled since I moved in 11 years ago. That's why we're still in a two-bedroom. The same is true of many of our neighbors. Most of the artists that once gave the city its reputation have long since been priced out of town. But the real estate developers do their best to maintain the facade. They seem to be the only ones remaining who would bother putting a "Keep Portland Weird" bumper sticker on their vehicles. But the stickers just look oddly out of place on a recent model Mercedes. The elephant in the living room is the living room. NPR reported recently that the cost of the average new home has risen by 50% since 2012. The constant rise in the cost of housing has been an unmitigated success on the part of capitalists that support both parties. But the costs are mighty. We are a far more economically divided society than we have been for well over a century, since long before any of the New Deal reforms came into effect. We are dying younger, and suicides linked to housing insecurity are skyrocketing. The impossibly high cost of housing is not just immoral and unjust. It is killing us. Meanwhile, the rich are getting richer than ever, and they're doing it on purpose, profiting from our misery, passing laws to make it easier for them to do so. My prediction: when the Yellow Vest movement comes to the United States, it will be about the cost of housing. In the cities of the U.S., renters now outnumber homeowners. Someday soon, the rent may be due for the billionaires, too.
I'm writing you this letter because among the choices, it's probably better than listening to voices raging in my head saying point and shoot. And after you're dead, your face meets my boot. I don't know your name, it's better that way, because I can't play this game. Who knows what I'll say? I feel like I'm burning, I've had it up to here. It's time that you were learning the meaning of fear. I live in these apartments, are your private property among your residents. Most of us agree that you're a piece of shit. How does that make you feel? We don't like you one bit, and that's for real. We think you're a thief, that you don't care. Seems your one belief is whatever the market will bear. Whatever you can get away with, what you could make us pay. If we ever get justice, you should fear that day, landlord. Landlord. But it's not just you, it's all your kin. The things you do cause the state we're in. You bribe the politicians so they'd let you off lead. Now the legal situation's just the one you need. For you to make millions, for profits to be high. But even billions won't be with you when you die. I hope you find a death you seek, meet the devil that you serve. If you live another week, that's more life than you deserve. Landlord. In the class war you're waging, there's no question who is winning. But if there's any justice, this is only the beginning. The next act in the play will be written by the tenants. And until your dying day, you'll be paying penance. Your assets will be seized, that's a f***ing given. You profiteers of misery, start spending time in prison. Then you can get a job, figure out what you do best. You can keep the house you live in, but we're taking all the rest. Landlord. Landlord.
This has been episode 23 of This Week with David Rovics. To hear other episodes and to find out how you can support the podcast and get a Make Popular Education Popular Again tote bag, go to davidrovics.com/thisweek. This version of the song, Letter to My Landlord, appears on my vinyl album, Historic Times. You can download the whole album for free by signing up to my email list at davidrovics.com. Hope to see you next week in podcast land.
All right, welcome back to Out There. That was a pretty intense song for Out There. Let it be said for the record that I here on Out There don't believe in demonizing anyone. Hey, I'm kind of a landlord myself. I was thinking recently as I was biking around, to demonize any group of people, whether it's like the police or landlords or politicians, whoever, it's like demonizing drivers, you know. It's like the problem is this system where, you know, cars control all this space. And, you know, the cars are full of individuals and every individual, you know, is in that car for their own reasons and has their own opportunities in life and all that. So even though I, as a cyclist, might feel like all these monsters are oppressive, the people inside aren't bad people. All right, next on Out There, I'm going to play something that I recorded in Knoxville, Tennessee last year at a theater. It was a panel about integration, and some women on the panel were talking about their memories of when their high school, Central High School in Knoxville, was integrated and how that felt for each of them. And honestly, I edited this clip, that was May of 2018, and I haven't listened to it since, so I hope it's good.
Yes, I'd like to share with you. I have a couple of reasons for this. And one thing is really just to cleanse my mind. Because since I was a white student, and I was not unusual in thinking that things would go on as usual at our house school after the blacks immigrated into East. And things changed. A lot of the social activities were done away with because of the fear that there might be mixing between the blacks and the whites. Some sock ops, we were not having sock ops anymore. Our Mr. Mountaineer, who was our mascot at that time, we did not have that contest anymore. There's several other things. And so it was more of a social pain for me and for many of us. Now, one thing I would like to throw in here is that the sports teams, I think the coaches were very pleased that they were going to get some of Austin's best sports heroes. But the white fathers especially were not too happy about this because they knew that several of their boys were going to be knocked to second string. And they had always planned on them being, you know, football heroes. So there was a lot of changes in this actual school social life.
Can you remember the first African-American either classmate or friend that you made and how that one individual might have made a difference in your high school experience?
Well, I know the first conversation that I had with an African-American was the first day of school. We'd been handed our paper schedules, and it would say, you know, you will go to certain class, room 110 or whatever. He was in my homeroom, and we were standing there looking at those out in the hall, and he says, and I was looking for 110 health, and he says, do you know where room number 213 is? I said, brother, I'm as lost as you are. And we both kind of looked at each other, and after I said it, I thought, oh, man, I don't want you to think I'm trying to get friendly with you or anything. And we both went our merry ways. And I do hope that he found his room number, because if not, he may be roaming the school now looking for it, because part of the Old East High School is now part of Austin East. And I have one other little story I'd like to tell, that the first conversation I had with a black friend, she was in class, and I was brushing my hair, and she looked at me, and she says, how many times do you wash your hair a week? I said, oh, I have to wash it every day. My hair's so greasy. She about fell out of her desk. She started laughing. She says, honey, I'd be bald-headed if I washed my hair every day. And I asked her why, and she explained her hair difference from mine, and it was very dry and so forth. And that was the kind of fun things we had. We didn't really exchange a lot of personal information, like, you know, phone numbers. They were when I was there. And
well, we do know we're talking about 1964.
Right. Exactly.
We put that in context. So was there, did you have an opportunity to be in any kind of school activity that was integrated at East in 64?
Not until later. Actually, the whites sort of controlled any elected offices. At that time, like your student council, homecoming queen, that sort of thing. In my junior year, as more students felt comfortable leaving Austin and not feeling like they were traitors, because I think there was a problem there that some people thought, the Austin students thought, you know, you need to stay here at your home school. And then things started changing. And this is where I'd like to say that I realized that what integration was all about, and the fact that integration was going to affect me, because this meant that the blacks were not going to stand, you know, in the back. They were going to come up and be cheerleaders and all this sort of thing. And I just never really thought about that.
We appreciate your candid viewpoint of when you were a freshman. We were talking with some in our group getting ready for today's panel discussion, and one person brought up that oftentimes the integration of schools was always through the perspective of black students going into a white school and hearing that side. Today we wanted to make sure that we heard from a white student about black students coming in. We could spend 2 days, a fortnight actually, talking about the black experience going to an integrated school. But I want to shift to, as we put things in context, I want to ask Quenika Moten, who represents the today's civil rights movement, because she was the hope of our past. Quenika is in her early 30s, and so I want to ask her the benefit, or if she knew the benefit, if it was part of her consciousness that with her school choice and those things that she was able to do growing up. Do you hear stories from Mama Nim?
Absolutely. I'm a native Memphian, so growing up in Memphis, where this National Civil Rights Museum is located, we took a field trip there annually. They did not allow us to forget the path that was paved for us. And I think that as a young professional here, I absolutely appreciate the work that Mr. Booker and people like him did for us.
And did you ever realize when you were making it, let me ask this, where did you go to college?
I went to the University of Tennessee, go Vols.
When you made that choice of coming to Knoxville to go to UT, did you, and I'm not saying that it had to be, because we're hopefully moving forward, but was there ever a thought of the people who had gone before you, like Theodos Robinson, some of the others who had to pave that way to make that even a choice for you? Is that part of the consciousness of young professionals today?
I think at this age, I think about it, but at 18, I don't think that it was on my mind, which is unfortunate, which is why I think events like this are important. So we have the opportunity to share with high school students that people paved the way for us to be able to have these opportunities.
That was a panel discussion at the Tennessee Theater in Knoxville, Tennessee, from May of last year. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. Democracy Now! Is coming up at 5 o'clock. Another announcement from Francis Crowe.
So what about the Code Pink meeting, Francis?
There's a Code Pink meeting at my house on Friday at 6:30. This is for women, largely, although if a man wanted to come, we wouldn't reject him. But we work together to try to bring about a more just society, stop the bombing of the children of Lenin, and various items like that. So you can come, and I'm at 3 Langworthy Road, Northampton. And one should eat supper before you come.
That's the Code Pink meeting this Friday, January 18th. And this is Gene Ritchie, Appalachian dulcimer player and folk artist.
I'm a packing my grip, I'm a moving on, for I'm a rambling laddie. And if the boat don't stop at the Philadelphia dock, I'll go on to Cincinnati. I'm moving on, I'm a moving on, for I can't stay here forever. All the steam is rising and the big wheels are turning, I'm moving on down the river. Is a fine old town, and so is Cincinnati. These streets all lined with the $10 bills, and the pretty little girls are plenty. So I'm moving on, I'm moving on, for I can't stay here forever. All the steam is rising, and the big wheels are turning, I'm moving on down the river. With the roving eye, don't choose the girl with money, but choose you the one with the truest heart, and kiss her and call her honey. And I'm a moving on, I'm moving on, for I can't stay here forever. All the steam is rising and the big wheels are turning, I'm a moving on down the river. That girl, she's a dear little thing, but the tears they fall and blind me. For I can't help but thinking once in a while about the girls I've left behind me. So I'm moving on, I'm moving on, for I can't stay here forever. All the steam is rising and the big wheels are turning, I'm moving on down the river. I'm moving on, I'm moving on, for I can't stay.
Swing and turn, jubilee, live and learn, jubilee.
on Saturday night, some will come on Sunday. If you give them a half a chance, they'll be back on Monday. Swing and turn, Jubilee, live and learn, Jubilee. I won't have no widder man, neither will my cousin. You can get such stuff as that for 15 cents a dozen. Swing and turn, Jubilee.